Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Joseph Hickman. He is the author of a remarkable new book called Murder at Camp Delta, A Staff Sergeant's Pursuit of the Truth About Guantanamo Bay. And he is that former staff sergeant at Guantanamo Bay, Joseph Hickman. Joe, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Thank you.
It's great of you to come on. It's even better for you to have written this book, which tells some truth about what's been going on at Guantanamo that some people didn't want you to tell. There's events that occurred on a particular evening when you were in charge of keeping watch over the camp and you saw some prisoners removed and put into a van. Can you describe what you observed and what you concluded?
That evening was June 9, 2006. I was sergeant of the guard, which means I was responsible for a lot of different posts all around Camp America and inside of Camp Delta. Camp America is the camp that actually holds the detainee facilities in Guantanamo. So I just started my duty, and I was in a tower inside of Camp Delta. It's called Tower 1. I was in Tower 1, which overlooks the detainee medical clinic, the Sally Port, which is the entrance into Camp Delta, and I have a clear unobstructed view of Camp 1, which I'm not far from there at all, or maybe 100 yards. Well, that night when I was in the tower, I saw a white van that we all called the paddy wagon down there. I saw the white van come into Camp Delta, back up to Camp 1, put a detainee inside of it, and then exit Camp Delta. As soon as it exited, it made a right, and then its first left, which means it was leaving Camp America. It was leaving the detainee holding facility camp. And that was kind of interesting because it was in the evening. It was on a Friday night. There was no military commissions around. Where were they transporting these prisoners? This prisoner made me think. Then about 20 minutes later, the van came back and repeated the same thing. Went up to Camp 1, put another detainee in, and left Camp America. So at this point, I'm alert. What's going on? Then it did it a third time. The third time it went to pick up a detainee, I decided to go to a perimeter area called ACP Roosevelt, Access Control Point Roosevelt, which is the exit out of Camp America, where vehicles enter and exit. While I was there, I saw the van leave Camp America on its third trip, and about 100 yards past ACP Roosevelt, it made a left turn. When it made that left turn, if it went straight, it would have went to the main base, where the McDonald's is and the PX and everything else, or military commission. But it made that left 100 yards past ACP Roosevelt, which means it could only went to two places. It could have went to the beach where soldiers and sailors go for recreation time, or it could have went to a facility that we found, me and a few soldiers, one day on duty called Camp No. We called it Camp No at the time.
The CIA referred to it as Penny Lane. Is that correct, as you later learned?
Yes, I learned later on in 2013 it was called Penny Lane, and it was a CIA facility off the book.
You saw the van come back later that evening?
Yes, it came back later that evening. I was making my rounds again. I was visiting the Sally Port in Tower 1, and I was in Tower 1, and the van came back. Tower 1 was the tower where the supervisor for all the towers stayed. That's why I had paid particular attention to it. When it came back, the van actually backed up to the medical clinic. And when it backed up to the medical clinic, it opened its doors at the entrance of the medical clinic. And then, you know, my view was obstructed, but they were obviously taking something or someone into the medical clinic. And then 20 to 30 minutes later, the lights came on. It was chaos all through Camp Delta, people running towards the medical clinic. And when I got out of the tower, and I saw a corpsman that I knew, and I asked her, you know, what happened? She said three detainees killed themselves. They stuffed rags down their throats. And I was shocked. And later on, I saw Colonel Baumgartner, and he said, we have a meeting 0700 when you get off your shift, and I'll fill you in what's going on. Well, we went to the meeting, and Colonel Baumgartner told us that three detainees killed themselves. They stuffed rags down their throats, but we're actually going to hear something different in the media. And not to discuss this with anyone. He gave us a direct order not to discuss it with anyone, not to tell our families, not to tell, you know, any reporters or anything like that. And we were being monitored by the NSA, which we were the entire time we were there. It was minding us of our communications were honored. So later on that day, I saw on the news that three detainees hung themselves in their cells. It was done by Admiral Harris, did a statement on CNN while I was in the chow hall. I watched it, and it was impossible. I thought they were in, you know, these three detainees were in Camp 1. If they hung themselves in their cells, I had several guards on duty that had clear, unobstructed views practically on top of Camp 1. They would have seen the detainees transported from Camp 1 to the medical clinic, and it just didn't happen. No detainees hung themselves in their cells or were taken from the medical clinic or taken from Camp 1 to the medical clinic. The only thing that was taken to the medical clinic was what was in that paddy wagon.
So Colonel Mike Baumgartner and Admiral Harry Harris and those in charge wanted those of you working there to believe that these prisoners had killed themselves in their own cells by stuffing rags down their throats, because you knew that's how the corpses arrived, and wanted the public and told the media that they had killed themselves by hanging themselves in their cells.
Yeah.
Both versions of which were known to you to be false.
Absolutely, it was impossible. I had three guards that were literally 30 feet away from the medical clinic on duty when this supposedly happened. 30 feet away. I had two guards in the towers that were 75 feet away from the medical clinic and a clear, unobstructed view of Camp 1 and the walkway all the way down Camp 1. I had a guard in the tower inside Camp 1 looking clearly at all the cell blocks and the walkway down to Camp 1. No one was transported that night from Camp 1 to the medical clinic.
None of those other guards have spoken out or said anything. None of your colleagues at Guantanamo questioned this story or went to the public with any dissenting voice, as far as you know.
They all questioned it, and they all came forward. We all spoke to the Justice Department back in 2009.
Really? How many people?
Yes. Seven people. So when we talked to the Justice Department, you know, that didn't, as you read in my book, it didn't go anywhere. After 10 months, they just basically closed the case. But those soldiers, they're still in the military, some of them. Some of them are in military intelligence now. And they were so discouraged that nothing happened that they weren't going to come public, you know, with the press or anything else. They felt like they were beaten down. And they, you know, they have spoke to my attorney. They spoke to my attorney first before they actually went to the Justice Department. They talked to Professor Mark Dembo at Seton Hall before they went to the Justice Department.
And you went to him after you ended your duty at Guantanamo and returned home and saw on the news another supposed suicide. Is that right?
Yeah, I was trying to put Guantanamo behind me and just try to write it off as just a horrible nightmare. And when I saw that other death on TV, it just brought everything back, and I knew I couldn't live with it. I had to get this out.
You would think that it would have been possible to go to the media, and you tried to go to several major media outlets, none of which had questioned the remarkable story, the official story, and none of them thought it was worth reporting.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you exactly what happened there. I know that they were very interested, and all of them, they believe me. They even said they did, but they, they had to confirm my story with the Pentagon, and as soon as they went to confirm my story with the Pentagon, they dropped the story. I mean, they dropped everything, and they wouldn't run the story.
This is 60 Minutes and ABC and NBC.
Yes. Yeah. And I had, I also went to I went to Russ Feingold, my senator, and that was Russ Feingold was he was remarkable. He wanted to get to the bottom of it. When he asked questions to the Justice Department, they told him it was classified. And when he was taken out of office, he actually his top aide called me and let me know that he had three regrets over his years in the Senate, three major regrets, and not getting to the bottom of those three deaths was one of his regrets.
Confirming John Ashcroft is in that list, is it not?
Yes.
I find it remarkable, though, that it wasn't classified. I mean, there was an official story. It was big news. Prisoners hang themselves as an act of asymmetrical warfare against us, as if the U.S. military were the victim of these suicides. You managed to find quite a number of contradictions and impossibilities, rigor mortis setting in faster than is physically possible, these prisoners hanging themselves in completely open, visible cells, and nobody noticed. How is it that that all of these reporters fell for it and just took the official story and reported it?
You know, I don't know I don't know what the Pentagon told them. I do know that that one big misconception they put out there about me was they said I was. They kept saying I was a perimeter guard. I wasn't in a position to actually know what happened that night. And by them saying, even Colonel Baumgartner's repeated that recently in Newsweek. That's a half truth about my duty at Guantanamo. I was a perimeter guard, but I also 50% of my work was inside Camp Delta where the detainees were being held. And that night, I was Sergeant of the Guard. I was inside Camp Delta where those detainees were. They keep trying to make it sound like I'm so far away from those facilities when I'm in them more than half. I was in them more than half the time in my duty.
So, yeah. And then
that was a big misconception, and a lot of people bought that, bought that line.
And the other guards that were working for you that evening agreed with your observations, right? It wasn't just you.
Absolutely. 100%. Like I said, now they're, I still speak to them, but some of them are just very discouraged. And since the book came out, I've actually had recently, other soldiers reaching out to me that weren't even in my platoon, saying, they're so happy I wrote the book.
Well, I would love to talk with any of them who have similar stories to tell. It's just remarkable that these were prisoners who were on a hunger strike, allegedly they were given all of this preferential treatment, and so no one was observing them, and then you and the other guards that would have seen what happened were never even questioned for the subsequent reports. How is it that looks credible and professional to everyone until you step forward and speak out?
My question exactly. I mean, there's the NCIS. We were after this, I figured, well, the NCIS will question all of us.
This is the Navy Criminal Investigative Service. Is that right? Okay.
Yes. And we were waiting, and they just never came around. Why wouldn't you question the tower guards that were looking directly over top of the camp that night? They're the eye in the sky in those camps. They would be some of the first people you would talk to. And as far as the, you know, standard operational procedure is those detainees had to be checked on every 3 minutes. And if they were these detainees, if you buy the government's version, they hung for 2 hours without being noticed.
Yeah. So
it just doesn't, none of it adds up.
So you ended up working with this law professor that you mentioned, Mark Denbow, at Seton Hall, University Law School's Center for Policy and Research, and with his graduate student researchers, and you came to some conclusions about what, in fact, probably was done to these three prisoners who were killed and others like them, and why. What do you think was going on, and toward what end?
Well, we did a lot of research on this, and we know that it was a special access program in Guantanamo, and it was a place to where we were doing human experimentation on what worked and what didn't work as far as interrogation.
Human experimentation sounds rather nasty and illegal. Is that really what was happening, Pete? Humans were being experimented on with drugs?
Yes, they were. And it sounds nasty and it sounds illegal, and that's why I stated that way, because it should sound nasty and illegal. That's what it is. When the detainees arrived in Guantanamo, you got to figure, they're most of them came from Afghanistan. They're on a 17-hour flight. They are sensory deprived. They don't have, we take away their sight with goggles that are blacked out. Their hearing, we put rubber gloves on them so they can't feel anything. It's complete sensory deprivation for 17 hours while they're on that flight. As soon as they get off the plane, they are given a drug called mefloquine. Mefloquine is an anti-malarial drug. Well, the problem is there's no malaria in Guantanamo. They were in our custody for over 2 months and had medical care in Afghanistan. None of them had malaria. Why are we giving them this drug? But not only are we giving them this drug, we're giving them this drug at 5 times the dose it's prescribed. And this drug is an hallucinogen. It is fat soluble. It'll stay in your system for 30 days or more. And it causes serious issues. There has been a lot of research on this drug, and it causes serious issues with people that take it. I mean, some people should just look up mefloquine and see the side effects. It's from the clonine family of drugs, which was actually studied by the CIA in the 1960s and 70s under the MKUltra program. And this is what we're actually giving these detainees after they finish that flight, sensory deprived. Within 24 hours, they get this drug, and then they go into solitary confinement for 30 days. The 30 days, they're not allowed to see anyone except their interrogator. They're not allowed a Quran or any reading material. They're totally dependent on their interrogator. Now, does that sound like human experimentation?
I have to think it does. As you also pointed out in your book, this drug was not given to any of the guards, any of the staff, including workers from countries with greater risks of malaria, or any of the Haitians who were kept at Guantanamo in the 90s, just to these prisoners and just in this huge dosage. And you point out also in your book that many of these prisoners were clearly not any high-level targets with information that could be useful, and certainly not after months and years in captivity, yet they continued to be, quote-unquote, interrogated year after year.
Yes. And by the way, I wanted to say that how I described everything with the sensory deprivation and the drugs, that is also can be found in a in a study that was done by the Defense Intelligence Agency studying the Russians and the Chechens interrogation techniques. It was done, I believe, in 1972. So it's the exact same, almost verbatim, what they were doing.
What the Russians were doing.
Yes.
So what the Russians were doing in the 70s is being tested out by the CIA in the 2000s in a giant experimental lab that Americans think of as a prison camp.
Yes, and also the Bitterman Principles, which was the study on the North Koreans, how they treated our POWs in the Korean War. You can find all the things that we do in these studies.
So these prisoners who come into Guantanamo, whatever their background, criminal or otherwise, they're put through this process that you described of deprivation of senses and overdose of this hallucinogenic drug and solitary confinement, and then are put into this extreme heat in these cages in which they're treated like animals. It might not be so shocking if they actually behave like animals at that point.
Absolutely. It was horrifying. My first day in Guantanamo, when I first saw the detainees in those 6x8 cells, it was a huge shock to me, because I did prison work in the States. It was nothing like I saw in the States, and it was it really made me question. Every soldier takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And it really made me question that oath. I really was torn.
You describe a riot that occurred, and you sort of led the suppression of that riot, and you reflected on it in the book after the fact, and you said that your conclusion was that these prisoners were probably not motivated by religious or ideological beliefs, but by simply having been pushed beyond human limits by the horrible conditions of the camp. Is that your analysis still?
Yes, but it is my analysis, and I know I'm looking at it through tunnel vision. I wasn't in Iraq or Afghanistan. I'm sure some veterans there could argue that case in point with me, but through my lens, that is my point of view.
Because I've spoken with veterans, certainly not all of them, but I've spoken with a number of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and some who've joined up with groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War, who have said that they came to a similar conclusion over there, that people fought to defend their homes and fought back and pushed back, not because their religion told them to or because they hated us for our freedoms, but because their country had been invaded and occupied and they'd been treated so horribly.
That's very interesting and good to know.
Because I'm just curious what your analysis is of the overall so-called war on terror, because it's a very interesting book in which you very clearly and honestly lay out these crimes in Guantanamo, but you repeatedly say that you're a believer in patriotism and militarism and the wars and so forth, and I'm trying to understand how that still fits.
Well, I still believe I consider myself a patriot. I don't even consider myself a whistleblower. I consider myself a soldier trying to report a war crime. I believe the military is really good for some people. I believe a young man joining the military can learn a skill and get college money and be there to defend his country. The problem is people higher than the people joining are abusing the power of war. And that's not the soldier's fault. That's the politicians and officials that we put in office.
Well, I think that's clearly all correct. I just wonder if your story from Guantanamo and similar stories from Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Libya and so forth are all combined together, and the wars are as dishonestly presented in each and every aspect as they were by the PR office down there in Guantanamo. Perhaps the whole thing is a mistake.
Oh yeah, I don't support this war. That's quite certain of that.
Oh well, that I didn't get from the book. That's
I support the military. I support the troops. I still volunteer, you know, with veterans and try to help them adjust to society. I do a lot of volunteer work, but you know, I disagree with the war in Iraq. It's ridiculous, and Afghanistan. Yeah, I don't agree with the war, but I love the soldiers.
Well, we have to love the soldiers, and we have to apologize to them, and we have to stop sending them to such wars. But maybe we have to stop imagining that there might be a good war coming down the pike next month or next year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our military, we need a military, that's obvious, but it should only be used in extreme circumstances, and when there's no other alternative. We've never, not in my lifetime, and I go back to Vietnam, I mean, we have never fought a justifiable war that I remember.
That's a very interesting analysis, and I hope people listen to your voice. We don't have much time left. I wanna ask about how your story is getting out now, because when you first tried to go to the media and these major television outlets wouldn't do it, a reporter named Scott Horton managed to put an article in Harper's, and Keith Olbermann talked about it on MSNBC, and now you've come out with a book. How much media attention is it getting? Are the major media outlets covering this the way they should be?
Well, the major media has not yet, but there is interest, and we are planning on doing a few programs in the future, near future. But right now, they're just talking to my publicist, Simon Schuster, and working out the arrangement. So it's up in the air. We'll see what happens, I guess. I never get my hopes up on anything like that, because I've been pretty disappointed before.
Well, I suspect that most people in the United States are unaware that that men have been drugged and experimented on to death in Guantanamo, and they certainly ought to be. It doesn't appear to be in any dispute. You've written a remarkable book documenting the evidence. The book is called Murder at Camp Delta by Joseph Hickman, and we have been having the pleasure of speaking with Joseph Hickman this week on Talk Nation Radio. Joe, thank you very, very much for coming on the program. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.